This is all of it. Today, ahead of Thanksgiving, we're thinking about family. And in the case of our next guest, we're thinking about what it takes to be an advocate for your family when some in the medical community only see the problem, not the person. Some expectant mothers really get invested in, maybe even a little obsessed with, their prenatal self-care, like poet and professor Heather Lanier. She ate organic foods and avoided soft cheeses. She slept only on her left side. She kept her cell phone as far away as possible. As she writes in her memoir, quote, "I was trying to make a super baby." Everything that Heather planned for and attempted to manifest had to be reconsidered. Her daughter, Fiona, was born with an ultra-rare syndrome called Wolff-Hirschhorn. Now, how unusual is this? For a disease to be rare, it means 1 in 1,500 people have it. Wolff-Hirschhorn occurs in 1 in 50,000 people. Doctors warned Heather and her husband that Fiona may never walk, never talk, never feed herself. They cautioned that she might not live more than a few years. One doctor even compared Fiona to a plant, saying these words, "It's either bad seed or bad soil." But Fiona's birth also made Heather confront her own internalized ableist thinking. It led her to examine what it means for a life to have meaning and loving your kid as is. She wrote in her book, "Fiona was teaching me grace." Heather has been writing and speaking about her daughter and ableism in America for years. Her 2017 TED Talk has been viewed more than 2 million times. Part of her work is explaining what it takes to be an advocate for your family when some in the medical community just don't see the person. Heather joined us in July to talk about her memoir titled Raising a Rare Girl. I asked her what she imagined when she envisioned a super baby.
I think there's been some good research on this, that a lot of women are trying to make sort of like the perfect baby. And actually when what they found is that means like normal or average, you know, like the person that just sort of like passes all the tests. But I do think I was also trying to, by all the tests, I mean like all the, you know, post-birth tests, like everything checks out, everything looks normal. But I think I was also trying to, take the DHA fish oils to make sure the baby's brain was as high functioning as possible. And, obviously these are like middle class, aspirations. So it's pretty privileged, aspirations to endeavor upon. But, I was definitely gripped by this sense of needing to make sure my baby was as well prepared for the world. And what I really reflected on as I thought about that was I was likely trying to avoid suffering. Like I just wanted to make sure they were as well prepared to not have to face suffering in the world. It turns out you can't avoid that. So that's a part of life.
You know, women during pregnancy, I found anyway, that you're sort of sold a mythology about pregnancy and how to have children. You're told stories about right and wrong, and you need to buy this, and you need to buy that, and you have to do this, and you have to do that. There's just a lot of information coming at you, especially if it's your first child. You sometimes don't know what to do with all this information. What stories did you believe when you were first pregnant? What part of the mythology got to you?
Yeah, oh, that's such a good question. And I would love to like sit around with women all the time and talk about that. I definitely felt like the unmedicated birth was the gold standard I should really, really work hard for. So I kind of bought into the mythology that like I have to try to keep the baby's entry into the world as, as smooth as possible, which would likely mean like, you know, vaginal birth and unmedicated if I could handle it. So I'd done like research on how, you know, one intervention will lead to another. And then C-sections are really, you know, the rates of C-sections are high in America. So I knew that there was a lot of intervening in women's births and I wanted to trust my body. Other mythology, I mean, that was probably a big one.
Had you had any indication during your pregnancy that there might be any sort of issue?
Yes. We definitely had a clue that things were different. Things are different than what people would expect. And that was because I always measured small. So, you know, they would do, the ultrasound at, I don't know, 10 weeks or something, and then 20 weeks. And Fiona was always she'd always kind of started to measure at 2 weeks later, 2 weeks younger than we knew. And I always got a kick out of that because the medical world just sort of decided that I didn't know when, basically I didn't know when I had been ovulating, and that she was conceived 2.5 weeks after I knew she was conceived. So I just sort of let them believe that, because they seemed comfortable with believing that, like, they knew more about my body than me. And then I just got to keep this secret that I believed she was actually 2 or so weeks later. So she was always small. And that's kind of a, an expression of the syndrome, that, that people with this syndrome are tiny, even when, like, she and I both eat tacos, and I'll eat 3 and she'll eat 3, and she's 30 pounds at age 9. And I'm, you know, a regular size human being. So that was just part of her genes, you know, to be tiny. And that was definitely in utero, too.
My guest is Heather Lanier, and the name of her memoir is Raising a Rare Girl. The first indication that something might not be right is right after the birth. You write, "I turned my head to the nurse beside me. 'Is the baby okay?' I asked. Labor thrust a woman into the psychological stratosphere, and I was coming back down. But the nurse didn't answer. A few minutes later, though, the midwife returned with my new family member. 'She's fine, just small.'" So, as you mentioned, her size actually is a sign of Wolf Hirschhorn. Do you remember, if you mm-hmm. think back now, deep down, did you really understand that there was something off about the situation right after you gave birth?
Well, so I would say that, so you say, like, when you knew something was right, wasn't right. And I would say that everything was absolutely right about Fiona. But from a medical standpoint, something was different. Like, right. She has a genetic anomaly. So on one hand, I'm in a hospital room where everyone's like, this isn't right, because mm-hmm. there's a bell curve of baby sizes, and it's 5 to 10 pounds, which is actually a pretty generous full-term, you know, baby weight. You can be anywhere between 5 and 10 pounds, and everyone's like, oh, this is standard issue. But Fiona was 4 pounds, 12 ounces. So they were like, well, there's a reason for this. And there was a reason. It's because her genes are different. She was absolutely mm-hmm. right. But we just needed to know this like component of her life, which makes her life quite different in many ways. So yeah, I think as soon as she came out, I mean, I had a birthing plan, and it just, like all of the sort of naturally minded midwives had told me, we'd asked for the cord to not be cut immediately, and the midwives that were delivering me were pretty, like, they seemed to imply they would be respectful of that beforehand. But once she came out, they asked my husband to cut her cord immediately. So I knew in her first second that something was worrying to the medical world about her. I carried that fear all the way through, and we didn't know what that was for the first 4 months.
Yeah, I actually kind of meant the energy in the room, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did you feel
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, totally. Yeah, as soon as she came out, the midwife said, oh, what a little peanut, like a little peanut. But I knew something. Everyone was upset. And even Justin says later, my husband says, oh, you knew that, like, they were worried, but he didn't know why. This was our first baby, and my glasses were off, and I have a pretty strong prescription. So I didn't know that she was as tiny as everyone had known that, you know, everyone else could see that she was. So,
for our listeners, would you explain what it means for a child to have Wolf Hirschhorn syndrome?
Yeah. So she has a deletion on the top part of one of her fourth chromosomes, and it's about, she's missing about 100 genes that most other people have. So in some ways you could say she's not missing them, she just doesn't have what most other people have, but it's a deletion. So it's like a chunk that, in the process of meiosis, in her conception, or what, like the sperm or the egg that made her was missing that little bit as well, and so all of her cells are missing this little bit. And as a result, she has some like similar features as other kids with the same deletion. She also has some of the same interests sometimes as them. Like, it's always interesting when you get together with parents of kids with this syndrome to learn that they all like to many of them like to cross their legs, like, way more than other kids. And many of them love music. But it also means she has a lot of challenges like developmental disabilities, developmental challenges. So things do not come nearly as simply to her as to a typical baby.
My guest is Heather Lanier. It's a memoir called Raising a Rare Girl. You know, part of this book is you're really, really honest about having to check yourself in this process. You check the medical community, which we'll talk about in a minute, but you also had to check yourself about, you know, shifting from a I'm going to fix this mentality to this is it. What was the start of changing your own mentality about your daughter's life?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the start was the natural flow of love to her. You know, like she was an amazing, beautiful, dewy baby, just like any parent probably many think of their babies. And yet I also knew that she was very troubling to the doctors. So I just sort of followed that love, you know, like I followed my awe for her as a being. And then also got to check that awe against, like, once we had a diagnosis, against my own ableism and my own sense of what I mean by that is like a sense of an able-bodied life being somehow superior to a disabled life. All of that paradigm was in me in a way that I didn't know or had not had to face.
You know, after reading your book, I went back and I looked, looked up the physician's pledge about what doctors pledge. And they say, I solemnly pledge to dedicate my life to the service of humanity. The health and well-being of my patient will be my first consideration. I will respect the autonomy and dignity of my patient. I will maintain the utmost respect for human life. When it comes to treatment, your experience for treatment with your daughter, how were some doctors and medical and healthcare professionals not living up to this oath?
It became clear that there are some doctors who saw her as less than human, who didn't see her as having, the full dignity of humanity. The one time I had to call a medical professional and say, and I don't write about this in the book, I had to say, last time when you looked at Fiona, you said she is a small, weak thing. You need to not use that language around her. And some people would say, oh, you should have broken up with that doctor immediately. But in some ways, the woman meant well. Like on the whole, she was a good person. She worked well with what she, she did a good job at what she did. And we were in Vermont and there was no one else to go to. So that woman I was willing to work with, but there were other people who just, half the doctors that we saw, we would have to sometimes walk away from just to find somebody who saw our kid and said, hey, it's great to see you. And then treated them like a human and never would have used the word thing, even to describe her.
What did you learn about advocating for your child and advocating for oneself within the medical community?
Definitely instincts are key. So, trusting my instincts when somebody, when someone walks in the room and if I just have this feeling that if they don't honor her as a human being, and it's just a kid, if they don't just say like, hey, like engage with her, engage with something that like she's wearing, what does her shirt say or something? If there's a sense of like treating her like a medical file, and not a full person, then we don't go back. That's one thing. The other thing is, there's probably a number of advocacy tricks, but another key thing is that when I do find those people, who they often give the best medical advice too. Like the doctors who see the whole picture of a person. When I do find them, I put my trust in them. So I put my trust in myself first. And then I put my trust in the doctors I find. I try to assemble a team of people who I think are looking at her as a whole person.
My guest is Heather Lanier. The name of her new memoir is Raising a Rare Girl. Your family expanded. You have a second child. You're like all of us dealing with this during a pandemic. How is Fiona doing? Mm.
She's good. She's great. She needs more interaction than she has, like everybody else, particularly any extrovert. I suspect she's an extrovert, and her parents are not. So she's doing great. But yeah, she did not have school like anybody else for 3 months, and I don't know what the fall brings. And any kid who needs the kind of support, like she has a one-on-one aide at school, and you know, that's, school is just, remote learning is just not effective for kids with disabilities and kids with complex IEPs. She's a happy kid, but in terms of education, it's a hard road right now.
That was my conversation with Heather Lanier about her memoir, Raising a Rare Girl.